Accession number 12274, reel 2.
Captain Fancourt, reel 2. You were talking about Robert Shaw.
Yes, sir. Robert Shaw and I were walking around the grounds, and we saw these various trees were planted in memory of various, mostly grand duchesses and German relations of the old Queen Victoria. And we had a talk, and we said it'd be rather nice to plant a tree in memory of our term mates who were killed in the Battle of Jutland. So he knew how to get it done, because he'd been at Osborne before, and we went ahead with this idea, and we planted a tree. There were only four of the term left at this time, which was October 1990, we put a plaque there by the little tree. It was an oak or something, and said in memory of the 14 members of the Grenville term, 1913, who were killed at the Battle of Jutland. So that was rather interesting to make a note of that, because there were so many of us who were lost in that time, and all so young, you see. We weren't even 16 then, you see, or just about 16.
How did you feel about being based at Rosyth rather than Scarpa?
Oh, we were so jolly lucky. We used to go ashore and play golf and go to Edinburgh and go to the pictures and things, and your poor old grand fleet was sweating it out in the jolly old Scarpa Flow, which I know too well, as a matter of fact. No, we were rather precious boys, the battle cruisers, I say. We would see quite a bit, but when we were in harbour, we had a splendid time.
What was the Princess Royal like to live on?
Or like any other big ship. no better, no worse than majority of ships in those days. They're a bit better now, but they have refrigerators and air conditioning, that sort of thing. But ships were pretty basic in those days, and they worked all right.
Can you tell me what your other First World War memories are after the Battle of Jutland, please?
Yes. In March 1918, having been at sea for 2 years and a bit, we were all promoted acting sub-lieutenants. We got our first gold stripe, which was the best stripe you ever get. Even if you go to Admiral of the Fleet, I think your first sub-stripe is the best one of all. And off we went. Most of us, I think, went off to small ships. I was appointed to a fleet minesweeping sloop called the Camellia. They were splendid little ships, really. They were built largely in small shipyards on a merchant navy basis, and they were originally intended for fleet minesweepers, but they weren't ever used for that, or very few of them were. They were nearly all used on on patrol and escort work. They had 2 4-inch guns, and that's their main armament. The Camellia was based in Queenstown when I was appointed to her, and employed on Western Ocean convoy duty. There were only half a dozen sloops there. The Camellia was a sloop in those days. But there were about 30 American destroyers who came over in 1917 when the Yanks came into the war. And it was really Western Approach's main convoy base. And we did quite a lot of convoying. But one of the interesting incidents we did have was in May 1918. We were told to go up to Dublin, lie alongside the jet at Kingston under sealed orders. And my captain, who was a charming fellow, I was very fond of him. Well, he was a bit of a rogue, but he was awfully a nice chap. Opened the packet when we got there, and we found that we were to give accommodation to all the bad men of the Irish Republic who'd been creating all this difficulty. They had the rebellion in 1916, and all the people who'd organized that were to be arrested and brought down to our ship, and we would take them to Holyhead. Well, we had them all there. We had De Valera, we had Daryl Figgis, we had Countess Markovitch, we had all the important people who were running the revolution in those days.
What impression did they make on you?
We didn't see much of them. We put them under armed guard on the seaman's mess deck, and we put Countess Markovitch in the wardroom, and she was really an attractive woman. So, of course, she was very much of a lady, Countess Markovitch. She was, I've forgotten what her family was, a Patton, I think. Not sure. Anyway, had we been torpedoed on the way across, it would probably solve the Irish question for quite a long time. They might have, my services might have been included in the day, which wouldn't have done the Navy very much harm, but they've done the Irish a hell of a lot of harm if all that lot had been clobbered. But they weren't. We duly got Holyhead and disembarked them to a military guard, and they marched off, and we went back to convoy and patrol work.
Did they behave themselves on board?
Yes, they did, except De Valera. I seem to remember De Valera was a bit of a nuisance. He kept coming up asking to see the captain, and we had to go down and talk to him something. Not, it was only a few hours anyway, but it's an interesting incident, really, when you come to think of it, looking back on it. So then we went on to continue the convoy escort work in the Atlantic, which was very much the same way you did the last war. Well, the German submarines were operating. One of the last convoys we did before the armistice was to escort an empty fast convoy of troop ships back to about 14 West, and they came back across to America. And one of them was torpedoed. A very rough day it was, too. A very fine German attack. He came in and he put a couple of torpedoes into a big, I think she was a Canadian Pacific boat, and sank her. But we didn't get very much to do with that. I think we ran around and dropped a few depth charges, but that's all we had in those days. There was no ASDIC, never forget, and there was no means of detecting submarines.
But did you not get mentioned in dispatches?
I did. I got mentioned in dispatches merely because my captain was a very nice chap, and he liked me, I think, when we paid off. And he's awfully good to me and trained me and showed me how not to behave in many ways, but showed me also how to behave. He's a wonderful chap. In fact, I done a bit of for him, Mark. We had one or two incidents which was really quite alarming. We were in Brest, and I was first lieutenant, and there was a very nice R&R lieutenant who was navigator, a splendid chap. And we'd been at Brest for 24 hours waiting for another convoy to take out. And that we were due to sail, what you say, 8 o'clock in the morning. And there were 4 American destroyers, or 5, I think, and ourselves, just 6 escort going out. Time arrived for the escort to proceed, the American senior officer, my command or something, and no captain. We hadn't got our captain. He'd gone ashore on his own and hadn't come back. So we had a little consultation, the navigator, myself, and the chief. And the chief was a very nice chap, a warrant officer. And we made a signal to the senior officer, regret, Camilla has a small minor breakdown, will join convoy as soon as defect is made good. So we sat there for half an hour and no captain. So then, just the way we begin to say to ourselves, well, we have to say it's all right, have to go without him. We saw a little boat coming along, pulling along like this, and there was a little Frenchman, a very small little boat, sculling away, and there was our dear captain sitting in the stern sheets, looking as happy as could be. Came alongside, worked him up the gangway. I remember taking him along to his cabin and saying, I think you better turn in, sir, now. He said, oh, yes, yes, I'll turn in. And we turned him in, and we took the ship to sea. And he came up the bridge 25 later, happy as a sandboy, and never said a word to anybody. But you really could. But we were very fond of him. Another occasion, I remember he got mixed up, some Americans came on board. Of course, we were the only ship in Queenstown had any drinks on board. The sloops had, you see, the American destroyers were all dry. And the great difference was they were told they were not to call on our ships, because their captain, who was in the depot ship, would have said, all my chaps be over in the sloops drinking all the time in harbour. So he wouldn't allow them on board. But of course, the captain could ask somebody on board. And our captain asked him, a Yank on board, and they had several bender. There was a conference to be held at the CNC's headquarters at Queenstown, which my captain's got to go to. And this was clearly no state to go to any conference. So I went to it, and I said to the staff officer operations, I said, who's a friend of my captain, I think the captain's not very well today. He's had terrible temperature. Can I stand in for him? He's really a sub. And they said, oh, come along. So I sat in this conference with all these brass hats and things around me. And, well, so old Bannerman was sleeping it off in the Camilla down in the harbour. But, oh, we had great days. Another occasion, his wife was there at Queenstown, too, and a little daughter. Another occasion he got mixed up the Yanks, and he couldn't go ashore. He was too tight. So I went ashore and went up to his house and said to Mrs. Bannerman, I'm afraid the captain is not very well. She said, oh, I've had this before. I'm not going to have this anymore. So I said, well, what am I going to do? She said, I'm going to leave. So she went upstairs and she packed 2 suitcases, and she took her little daughter by the hand, and really just a quarter mile walk down to the station and said, I'm going to leave. So I carried one suitcase, she carried the other, and the little girl by the hand, and we went down this quarter mile to the station to catch the Dublin mail train. Got down there, the train had just gone out. So I said, well, that's all right now, let's fix that, isn't it? And she said, well, I suppose it is. And I went back to the ship, she went back to her.
I think you saw the end of the German fleet at Scarpa Flow, didn't you?
Oh, that's another one, yeah.
Can you tell me what you remember about that?
Yes. Yes, you mentioned this, mentioned dispatches. Well, I think I deserve to mention dispatches, considering the amount of things I did for my captain. And I don't think, and mark you, he was such a splendid character that you all these were laughed off in the end. Mark you, he got caught up in the end. He got promoted commander, which he really was a pretty clever thing to have done, considering the way she behaved in many ways. But he really did cut loose one time. He was commander of a ship somewhere in the Mediterranean, and he was sent home and put in the trial list, which was very sad. Oh, and the German fleets, when they were sunk at the Scarpa, I was in the Royal Oak then. We paid off the Camellia in Devonport, and it was April 1919. In fact, the Camellia was, we were anchored in the Sound. We came over from Queenstown, we anchored in the Sound, and there were these six little sloops there. And nobody took the slightest notice of us. We had no signal, no orders from the Admiral. Nobody came out, no captain of the dockyard, anything. We swung around there for an hour or two. And then our chummy ship made a signal to the Camellia. I think there must be a game of bowls in progress. I received an appointment to the battleship Royal Oak. And joined her at Scarpa Flow, where the 1st Battle Squadron and a flotilla of destroyers were doing duty as guard on the German fleet, which was lying anchored pending the conclusion of the peace treaty, which was in progress in Paris at that time. The German fleet was manned with reduced crews and demobilized, in the sense they had no ammunition and such like on board. But otherwise, they were pretty well intact. And a fine looking fleet they were, too. Our admiral, who was Fremantle as far as I remember, took the battleships and the destroyer flotilla out of the flow into the North Sea to carry out gunnery and torpedo exercises, which took the best part of the day. On our return to Scarpa Flow, we found that the Germans had set about scuttling their ships, and the majority of them had gone down or capsized, lying on their side in shallow water, and so forth. The crews were in their motorboats and pulling boats being towed around the anchorage, waiting for us to return.
How did everybody feel about it?
Well, I suppose people, feeling the fleet probably was annoyance in a way, because we were supposed to be looking after them. But on second thoughts, it was a very good thing to have done, because the peace conference at Paris was debating on how to dispose of these ships. and certainly quite a number of them were first class, and some powers would very much like to have them. Insofar as the British Navy is concerned, it was a very good occurrence. But at the time, I suppose there was a feeling of annoyance. We had 200 or 300 of them on board each ship as prisoners. And the following morning, I think it was, we sailed to the Cromarty Firth, just round the corner, to turn the lot over to the military, where they were marched off to a prisoner of war camp.
What was the demeanour of the Germans on board the Royal Oak?
I think they were pretty fed up. I think, as far as I remember, there was a terrible amount of looting took place. The ship's company looted most of their gear and made an awful mess of things, and the captain and the commander tried to stop it by giving out orders and putting out sentries, but it didn't seem to happen. But they, most of their stuff was badly looted, and they didn't like that very much, naturally.
What type of things?
Oh, anything. Souvenirs, many little things. So we got rid of them, and we were sailed on down to the... I think it's off. We went down to South End in time for the Victory March round London, which was quite an adventure. Each big ship landed about 200 men, and the smaller ships took part accordingly, lesser numbers. And I was in the Royal Oak's company, or landing party, whatever you like to call it, and we went by train to London, where we were accommodated under canvas in Hyde Park for 3 days. And on the day of the Victory March, we formed up in Hyde Park and marched off. Distance being on the order of about 7 or 8 miles down through Victoria, across down to Vauxhall and down to the Southwark and all that there, around there, and then coming back across one of the other London bridges and up through Whitehall. And when we got to Whitehall, we were marching in 10 abreast, which was a terrible formation anyway. And the sailor boys hadn't been as good as marching anyway. Anyway, we got to Trafalgar Square, and the police were unable to control the crowd, and they pushed right into the middle of Trafalgar Square, and we had to get through this lot to get onto the Mall, to march down the Mall to the saluting base where the monarch was waiting to take the salute. And I remember so well, the police horses were pushing the crowd back, and we had to form into more or less single file and dodge between the tails of the horses, pushing one and then the other, to get up through every arch and form up in time to march by the saluting base for the king. Well, we did it all right, but it was a proper old turmoil. And looking back, it's one of these kind of things that only happens sort of once in a generation. And next time you did it, you'd do it rather better. However, it was a great thing. They held the country, it was bad behind the Navy, right so wrongly, and they threw packets of fags as we went by, and silver cigarette cases, and boxes of chocolates, and all that. We stopped every mile or two to have this stand easy, and all the girls came rushing out to kiss the sailors, and it was really quite a party. And then the next day, and we were in went back to our tents in Hyde Park, the City of London Guilds invited a number of sailors to each city company hall in the City of London to lunch. And I went off with my party in the Royal Oak to the leather cellars. And we got to the leather cellars and they laid out a wonderful lunch, lots of beer, God knows what, and food and cigarettes and la-di-da. And after lunch, it was quite clear we couldn't march the sailors back anywhere. They were quite an appropriate thing to do. So the lieutenant in charge of my company, I was number two, I suppose, said, we'll pipe leave. So we pipe leave from the Leatherhead Hall in the City of London. And he and I got into a taxi and went to my mother's flat in Kensington. And that was the end of that.
Could we jump ahead to something of interest to the War Museum especially, and that is the Turkish Peace Treaty, the Çanak Crisis.
That comes to the next step. Yes, I'll do that. After the after my time in the Royal Oak, I was appointed to Cambridge. There were 400 young officers distributed amongst the Cambridge colleges to do a 6 months course to sort of bring us up some of the education we'd missed as we went to sea so young. And we did 6 months at Cambridge, which was very interesting. It was a lovely time. I was in Caius College, very nice sort of undergraduates. They were all quite mature men. Most of them had been in the army. Some of them had got as far as the rank of major, and they were all the colleges were the same, and they were a very, very good lot of chaps there, and we thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think we learned a bit too. We did a bit of work, not a lot, but we did a bit of work, and had an examination at the end of it. I got a first, which I didn't think I deserved, but I did get a first at Cambridge in the naval thing. And then I was appointed to a ship which I'll say no more about. It was always a very unpleasant ship, and I was there a few months and was glad to get out of it.
What was so unpleasant about it?
Well, it was a prison ship. All the bad people in all the branches of the service seemed to accumulate there. And they told me that I was one of the young officers who was sent there because I wasn't a bad one. But anybody went to the Commonwealth, there was a ship called the Commonwealth, old battleship, and she really was a rotten old ship. Bad captain, bad commander, bad everything, really. And we didn't do very well. We were a gunnery firing ship. And
what do you mean it was a prison ship?
Well, it was a prison ship because all the bad people was pointed to her. That's why we called her the prison ship.
She was called the HMS Commonwealth.
Commonwealth, she was. Yes. But she was... She'd been well known for, you know,